So now that we've talked about strategies for protecting your assets, we need to look at one of the other things you mentioned as one of the dangers or liabilities, which is financial ignorance. There are a lot of myths out there about investing and ways of getting rich quick and ways of growing your capital. So from your point of view, somebody who's had a lot of in the trenches experience, I'd like to get some suggestions and overviews and general categories from you about managing the assets that you have so as to make them grow safely and in a way that is most productive.
Okay, great. The first thing that I want to just really focus on here, because we're talking essentially about investments. I manage a hedge fund and I have millions of dollars that I'm in charge of that I need to make good decisions on every day. But like every other person out there, I don't have a crystal ball. I have to do my due diligence on my traders and my brokers. And it may be a different level, it may not, but there's nothing that prevents me from making a mistake tomorrow if I don't do the basics. And for me, the basics are two things: due diligence and common sense. If an investment can't get by those two, then there is no reason to ever jump into it. There is no deadline that's too pressing. There's no return that's too impressive. There is no recommendation from a trusted friend that will ever take the place of due diligence and common sense. You have to find out, and sometimes it's hard, everything you can about an investment. If it's a private offering, it's harder. If it's public, theoretically, it's easier, although these days we know that even if it's a public company, maybe you're not getting the right information. I find that at least 70 to 80% of the people that I sit down with that have questions about their equity position in the company cannot read the financial statements. They cannot read the footnotes. Enron, obviously, right now is a big issue. Very few people have read the footnotes to Enron's financial statements. There's a lot of information there to let you know what was happening. Do you have enough information to make a good decision, yes or no, about a company, due diligence? But two, does it make sense to me? I can provide you a lot of information about great technologies and all sorts of things, but when you sit down and say, does it make sense now? Is there a financial model here? I'm making 80% a year doing nothing. Does that make sense to you? There are a lot of people that come with investments that they are ready to put $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 in. And when we finally kind of get through all the emotional side of it and the excitement, we say, well, can you just explain this to me like I'm a 7-year-old kid? And they can't, because it doesn't make sense. So investments need to be made rationally and calmly. And you need to understand that if you're going to win the game long term, if you're going to retire and you're going to have assets, you have to play the capital preservation game, not the earnings game. Because you can make 100% a year for 10 years. And if you lose 100% in the 11th year, you're still at zero. Or you can make 10% a year for 10 years and you'll be a lot better off. What I've found, and it's true even in my own situation, is that especially if you are a person who's entrepreneurial, you're risk-oriented, you're willing to take the risk and you can make it back if you lose it, supposedly. A lot of people will go that route, they'll lose it all, but after the first or second time they lose it all, they just get very, very mellow. They start to say, you know what? I'd love to jump into your opportunity. I'd love to invest, but if I don't have time to look at it, if I can't get my lawyer to approve it, if I can't do this, I can't do it. It's just a philosophy I have now. And then they finally start to build an asset base that lasts a long time, although it does grow at a very different rate than what they're used to.
This reminds me of a statement, something that I learned quite a while ago from a little brochure about commodities trading. And this was apparently something that was said by a rather famous commodities trader back in the 1890s. He said, hope and desire have no place in commodities trading. That struck me at the time because most people get into this high-risk, high-yield type of game because they hope they're going to get rich overnight and they want to make a lot of money. And he's saying those two factors are not allowed in this game because if you approach it that way, you are definitely going to get yourself into a lot of trouble very rapidly. So this thing that you just said about asset preservation and about the question, does it make sense, goes against our eagerness to get in there and be a success. And once, as you said, you've been up and down and up and down a couple of times, you mellow out. And the term I use for that is you become money proof. A lot of money moving under your nose doesn't cause you to take your eye off the goal where you're going. You're not going to run after it.
Right.
Because you're clear that money comes and money goes and you can make a lot and you can lose a lot very quickly. But if you operate on sound principles, then you're going to always be solid and you're not going to slide back unexpectedly if the market turns against you. So I'd like you to say just one more thing about this question of does it make sense? Can you give me an example of something that does make sense as an investment so we'll know exactly what you mean? And then a contrasting example of something that really doesn't make sense, like the 80% a year Show me a way that could make sense and show me a way that it probably doesn't.
Here's what makes sense. Good business makes sense. Profits make sense. I just was at a breakfast the other day and Kelleher, president of Southwest Airlines, was doing kind of a broadcast meeting. And, you know, he's talking about his stock since September 11th, and this is what now July, has doubled, I think. And what makes sense is that Southwest Airlines makes money. It makes money every year it has, every year for 25 years. It's a good stock. What doesn't make sense is the fact that you can buy energy contracts for a dollar, sell them for 50 cents, and call that a profit. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make rational sense. It doesn't make economic sense. It might somewhere make accounting sense. But when you're looking for investments to increase, there's got to be more than hype and promise. High-yield money games don't make sense. Things that stupefy the imagination can't be proofed up with verified returns, you know, some sort of a legal statement saying that, you know, here's what we've done and we can prove it because of this. The earnings of 80% a month, even 80% a year. The financial markets are so efficient that if there is an above average earnings on a legitimate investment that's of any time period, the financial market to some extent is going to notice at some level. If it's a small investment, there are sophisticated investors that are going to find that. If there's an investment out there that is looking for predominantly, you know, $10 million, but for you, we'll break it to $10,000. There's no investment that I know of legitimately that needs $10 million that will take $10,000 from anybody. There's rules against it. There's reasons why it's not efficient. I'd say there's a one in a million. And I don't want to say there's none because I've made money where it doesn't seem possible before, but I've done a lot of homework first. As an example, I manage a hedge fund. We deal with foreign currency. We deal with arbitrage, which is basically what I call risk-free trading. We know our profits before we make our trade. But me personally, I have a little higher tolerance for risk. And so I invest in a rather speculative in the currency markets. I have an account that I have a trader that I hired on, but I know how to hire people that can do it for me. So I get a professional. I believe that made me about 70% for the month, but I lost on a $70,000 account, $20,000 the other day when the euro went for, you know, it's unbelievable high. I saw it. I said, darn. And I went on to my business because it's money I can lose. It is money that I have set aside that I want to get a higher yield on it, but I in no way need that to live on. Need is another thing. I mean, if you need to have this return to pay the loan off that you borrowed to invest in, that's silly. That is not wise. I don't care how good it is. September 11th should teach us that no matter what we think we can get out of an investment, something that we can't foresee could happen. And therefore, if you are in that zone where you're investing funds that you hope and desire, you need to have these certain returns, I would say to really sit back and say, does it make sense? Would I advise my son or my daughter to do this if they were just starting out? It's a gut check.
So in the modern world, with the rapid international reaction from one market to another and unexpected things happening frequently and being more influential when they do happen, let's say a person is sitting with a certain amount of cash asset. What would be your shooting from the hip advice? What proportion should be in a low-risk, fairly liquid investment? And what proportion would you say for the average person would be wise to have in play? Something that's a little more adventurous, something that they might lose, but which would have more rapid upside development in the modern world. Still staying all within reserves and liquid positions so that you don't end up tied up and unable to react.
You know, that's a $64,000 question, obviously. And I've got to kind of step around it by saying that every person, every family, every investment unit, whatever that is, comes with a completely different set of needs. My advice most of the time is, first of all, define exactly where you're trying to get. Some people should have nothing anywhere but in a money market because they're set, they're fine, they can live that way. And why risk what you don't have to risk? Other people are younger and they're trying to aggressively pursue a goal and they have a high tolerance for risk. I might say you should have, you know, a 30% cash reserve. Well, you know, if I got $8, the 30% of that's 240, I'm not going to get very far. So I try to tell people that in my situation, I try to make sure I can live for a year on whatever I'm at by liquidating my car. You know, my car is cashed out. It's a fixed asset. I consider that part of my portfolio. So I think folks should live for at least 3 months on whatever they can touch right now. That means they don't have to call a broker to get it. They don't have to convert. It's just within their grasp, in their bank account, under their mattress. They can live for 3 months and not get scared, because once you get scared, the decisions start to get worse and worse and worse. Aggressive versus non-aggressive. Diversification was a big buzzword. The new reports now say allocation. You didn't have to diversify. If you're allocated properly, you were okay based on the last 10 years, etc. No one can predict the stock market right now. No one can tell you. And I talked about Southwest earlier. I didn't run out and buy Southwest stock because maybe it's at the peak of its earnings and maybe next week it's the Southwest Airlines. I mean, who knows what could affect the value? To the individual investor, to give that advice, it's nearly impossible. But I would say two things. One, fee-based financial planners. Find a planner that charges a fee for their services, not a commission on what they sell you. Look at their performance, especially in the good and the bad times. I'd rather have a planner that in the good times wasn't so good and the bad times wasn't so bad. I don't need a planner that's been at the top of the curve because that's easy to get to. But if they've kind of normalized returns for their clients, I think that's great. I think fee-based planning is the answer for the average person that doesn't want to become their own investor. Other than that, I would look towards the hedge funds heavily because hedge funds are highly personalized funds. They're smaller than mutual funds. Hedge fund managers can do a lot of different things that mutual fund managers can't do. A hedge fund is basically a private investment vehicle organized to pool investors' assets legally. Also, one of the best things you can do is to get your family and friends together, get a small amount of your assets, put them together, and then have monthly meetings. And instead of one person hoping, desiring, being greedy, and fearing, now you've got 20. And hopefully between all of you, you make good choices. So I'm a big advocate for investment clubs. Plus, it helps people get the minimums needed for better investments. Most of us at 5 or 10 or 15 grand can't even qualify to get something good. We qualify to pay commissions to people, and that's about it. A club could actually qualify it as a hedge fund if it wanted to because it's just a private pool. Usually a hedge fund has a sponsor. The sponsor is going to put it together, create it, pay the fees, and he or she's probably going to manage the hedge fund. And that's their role. The sponsor and the hedge fund itself is going to invest the assets of the hedge fund pursuant to a strategy that's well established. It's written in the documentation. Hopefully your hedge fund would have a track record. I have $200,000, let's say, in my IRA, and I want to try and diversify that low and medium risks. What do I do as a person? I look like a deer caught in the headlights. I give $20,000 here and $100,000 here. They don't take 20, only 60 and all this stuff. I give it to a hedge fund based on the fact that they have a couple million dollars or 20 million, whatever it is, and they're diversifying based on my needs. So I look at your hedge fund and you're a little bit what I consider to be aggressive because you've got some stocks here. Maybe you're in a commodities contract. Boy, but I look at this hedge fund here and it's a little more my style. I can actually diversify, meet my personal goals based on the hedge fund manager. And then I let it go. I trust the manager. I say, I'm going with you. Of course, I watch it and if something goes wrong. But if a manager is doing the right things, they made money for 4 or 5 years, there's a real good chance they're going to make you money and a really good chance they're not going to lose your money. This is an example of why I think hedge funds are powerful. If we look at the last 11 quarters in this S&P 500, and we look at the 11 worst ones, the S&P 500 is down about 44% total in those quarters. A mutual fund index is down about 43%. The hedge fund industry is down about 0.004%. So the best thing that I like about hedge funds is not their high-end earnings potential, because in the last several years, people have been able to earn a lot of money. It's the fact that in the bad years, the bad quarters, the bad weeks, hedge funds have outperformed in the sense of risk management. They have lost far less money, I mean far less money, than the S&P 500 and a major U.S. mutual fund indicator. If you're looking for the right mix for someone, a hedge fund might be the way to go. They're hard to find sometimes. You have to look for them. Hedge funds don't advertise. Mutual funds do. But if you look around, if you find the right planners, if you keep your ear open, you'll find a good hedge fund. You can get in there and with a kind of small asset base, get a real customized, personalized management versus what we have access to as the average consumer.
And the term hedge generally implies a protection against loss when the market is going in a contrary motion. Is that in fact true for the hedge fund? Is it the same kind of hedge as if you were going to buy gold or silver as a hedge against inflation?
The concept of hedging your bets, you know, you are taking positions that offset each other. You can do that more with a hedge fund than a mutual fund. Mutual funds are limited in how they can hedge against loss or how they can minimize their risk exposure. Hedge fund managers have a wide variety of products they can use and a wider range of strategies, where mutual funds are limited by SEC and different types of laws where they can't actually even employ some of the techniques that hedge funds do. Here's one of the main differences why I believe the performance is so different. Hedge fund managers are employed, make their living in providing returns in any kind of environment. Hedge fund managers normally work on a percentage of profit basis. Mutual fund managers usually get paid whether or not you make money. as an example, on the hedge funds that I manage, I simply take 10% of the profits. If a hedge fund that I was managing had made 20% for the year, I'd get 2%. If it lost 4% the next year, I'd make nothing. If it made 4% the year after that, I still make nothing because it's only back to where I had it last. In order to exist and survive, the hedge fund manager has got to make money every quarter. They've got to pay their bills, they've got to feed their kids, and they have more incentive to do that, and they have more tools to do that with.
So based on what we said in our earlier discussion about contingency fees for lawyers, this is the exact opposite. In a hedge fund, you want the manager to be working on a contingency fee. If they make money for you, they make money for themselves. If they lose money for you, they don't make any money. Whereas in the legal situation, that's not what is helpful when the attorney is trying to take your case only because of the money that can be made from it rather than because of the validity of the case.
Exactly. There's obviously a giant rift in the two worlds, hedge funds versus mutual funds. The bottom line is that if you look at the statistics and numbers, hedge funds' performance is up. You look at the way managers manage, and they're in a partnership with their investors. They are not making a commission, selling a product, whether or not you win or lose. Mutual fund managers get paid to manage the fund, regardless. Hedge fund managers get paid if they make money. Typically, in my experience, the people that step out on a limb and say, I'm good enough to get paid based on my earnings, are the best in the industry. Not to say there's not great mutual fund managers, but if you're looking at what takes more skill, what takes more self-resolve, what takes more confidence in what you're doing, to me, I like hedge fund managers because they only make money if I make money. And that, to me, is a great combination.
Getting back to the term hedge or hedge fund or hedge against inflation, what part in this total picture does gold, silver, precious metals play in the modern world?
I think they play a big part in the modern world. Fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of it's in commodity contracts. You know, my basic thought is commodity contracts are very dangerous. They're very volatile. In my world of currency trading, we trade spot. We trade dollar for yen, euro for pound, and we clear our contracts immediately. When you speculate on a six-month delivery of a pork belly or a dollar or gold, what you are saying there is somebody wins and somebody loses. And predominantly what you hear about in commodities are giant wins and giant losses. So when you see gold in a portfolio, when you see silver, if it's an actual asset, I think it's a great thing to have in there. If it is a futures contract, I think it is the same as a pork belly. And a lot of times people think they're buying an asset that's supposed to be relatively fixed and predictable when they're really buying some sort of a contract on future delivery. And they just have to be careful about that.
You mentioned before trading dollars against euros, and the sense is that you're trading currency against currency. And once again, the whole global currency picture is shifting as we go towards more regional currencies rather than national currencies. Can you explain just the basics of that whole trading market and what its particular attraction might be for someone starting out? What are the realities that they can anticipate?
Sure. And this is my favorite subject, so of course I'd love to talk about it. The foreign currency market. You know, it used to be if you travel across Europe in a seven-hour day, you could trade currencies three or four times. People have to trade currencies to conduct business. Right now, worldwide, there's about $1.5 trillion a day of volume going through the world currency markets. It makes the largest market in the world. I believe if you look at the U.S. equities and debt markets, so the stocks and bonds, I believe it's $300 billion a day. So it's something like 90 times as large as our what we consider to be a giant market. The currency markets are fueled by companies making large contracts across borders, banks hedging currency risks, and probably about 60 to 75% speculation. People like my company and others that are in the market trying to figure out which way currencies are going to go. The currency markets open 24 hours a day. It never closes. It's always open someplace. So you don't have issues in the currency market where, let's say it's 6 p.m. on Friday and something giant happens in a certain company's infrastructure. And so Monday morning, the stock is either going to be worth 98% less or 98% more. Currencies are 100% liquid and the market's always open. You can always get in or out of your currency. So if you're in the spot market, meaning you're buying just currency for currency, not taking futures contracts, derivatives, other types of high yield, high risk investments, I believe the currency market's the fairest market on earth. What makes it even better is the fact that there is no central exchange in currencies. If you are a day trading stock, You can see what the next 10 bids are for the stock, the price, the amount, where it's trying to travel through the ECN. And it's hard to make a killing when the information is so open. You know, information tends to drive profits down. In the currency markets, you cannot tell me right now what Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation will pay for the euro, either for 10 million, 100 million, or 500 million. You can't tell me what Bank of America will pay for a US dollar in terms of yen unless you get on the phone and you call. And based on your relationship, your trading background with the bank, and how much you want to trade, the price is going to be different for you. So we have a system where we actually are able to arbitrage our trades. And an arbitrage means that simply we know the profit before we execute. We're kind of brokering a trade. Our trader broker calls up as a bank, calls up on the bank's credit line and says, I'd like a bid buy sell on yen euro. And the desk has to give them a quote based on, they don't know if we want to buy or sell. They've got a risk exposure they're trying to hold on to or get rid of. And so if we could find a bank that's selling currency pair at 100 even, and another bank that's buying the same currency pair at 100.003, then we simply say we buy and sell that currency, $100 million worth, let's say. We broker the transaction, we take the spread, and we're out of the market. We're in and we're out. We don't hold positions at all. Because there is that decentralization, we can do that. Because you have to call and get the quote, it lets us operate in a very, very low-risk environment to make stable returns. We've done about 30 to 40% a year for the last 3 or 4 years. Our worst week ever was September 11th. Tremendously devastating day financially, along with everything else, probably the worst financial day in history. And for that week, we took a zero because since we had no trades in the market, we had nothing to lose. That's powerful to me. That's why I do this. That's why I employ that kind of trading. I can make more money trading different ways. Currencies are known to have very, very high returns, but the downside is that they have very, very high losses. So the arbitrage possibility, because of the way the market's set up, is phenomenal.
So you're providing liquidity in the market, being the arbitrageur, the one who sets up the trade between two entities which are trying to find each other. There's a price difference between what one is willing to pay and what the other one expects to receive. So the payer is paying more than the receiver is asking for. And you make that deal and take the difference and everyone's happy.
Right. But in a weird way, the payer is not really paying more. They actually are at parity because they each are trying to accomplish a different risk exposure. That's what's interesting about spot Forex. In a futures contract, you have a winner and a loser. In arbitrage trade, everybody wins because both sides offered us the price.
Right. They're protecting the position they need to protect.
Right. Or going after a new position. Or you can trade like six currency pairs in a row. Each one at a profit, and the sixth person still believes that they are accomplishing their goal.
Right. Now, why is this not yet like the stock market, where there is some kind of central processing database where everybody can see how things are moving? Why is it still in the sort of town market type of mode where you have different traders sitting at different phones working out the transactions in individual units?
It's a good question, and probably was one of my biggest questions when I initially left kind of the swing trading approach for the arbitrage was, how long do I have in this market? When is the technology going to remove the arbitrage possibility? Because to some extent, it has already. The reason that we are able to arbitrage is that we do it off of bank credit lines on the interbank market. There's not very many arbitrage possibilities outside of that. When we find them, they don't last for more than a minute. A minute would be a very long trade sequence in our life. But let me give you an idea of one reason why not, and that is, why isn't there a worldwide stock market? It's very seldom that you have a bank in New York buying US dollars from a bank in California. Most of the trades are done across borders. Really, the profitable ones are done in the hours where we're all in bed. You know, it's 1 a.m. and Europe's starting to open. It's a great time to do US-Europe because there's not much going on in the US to provide liquid US positions, yet Europe is looking for stuff. So it's hard to do a 24-hour international currency market. Let me go back to where I said I wondered how long we'd have an opportunity to invest arbitrage-wise. I had a good currency-based business going. We were making probably 80% plus a year. The problem would be is that we would lose 3, maybe 4 months a year. And although clients would say, you know, we could take the loss, and you'd say, no, we're going to lose 3 months. A good currency trader loses probably 40% of their trades. And that's a good one. And they just try to lose less than they make. So you tell clients, you understand that, and they say they do. Well, when we get an 8% loss, and the cell phone starts ringing off the hook, they didn't really understand what you were saying. To me, when I found the arbitrage, first of all, I didn't believe it. It was too good to be true. I needed to look into it. It took me 3 months to finish what I want to do due diligence-wise on it. But then my first question was, great, how long do I have? And this is the interesting part to me, is that the interbank currency traders, they are not going to rely on a push of a button, an electronic receipt, for a $200 million currency trade. They are going to rely on a phone call and the common understanding that we've got this trade cleared. If they don't have it cleared, they resolve it on the phone. My understanding from the traders is that although arbitrage may not always exist, currency trades will probably be settled the way they are today, especially in the large denominations that they're in, which made me feel really good as a manager because I want this style of management in my funds. It makes my life very, very easy.
So then the next question is this. Obviously, this is a highly professional technical skill to be able to trade foreign exchange or Forex. So for the average investor, this is not something they are ever personally going to do. They must work through a fund. Tell us a little bit about that level of participation.
I would say this. The way that we're talking about it, it's institutional. My advice would be don't trade your own money. If you're an engineer, stay an engineer and hire a trader. Go to a fund. Don't think that you can take a six-week class and enter the biggest market in the world, oldest market, with people doing it for 50 years and compete. Just like stocks, I just don't understand why you trade your own unless you have a passion for it and you want to study. Hire someone that's really good at it and live your life. With Forex, understand the gains are high, the risks are higher.
So there are Forex funds, or is foreign exchange part of a larger hedge fund profile?
As a hedge fund manager, I simply employ my funds into the Forex market. I could buy commodity contracts, I could buy tax liens, I could buy equity positions, all sorts of different stuff. The reason we use the Forex market is, as we've talked about, we just believe it's fair, we've got a great position in there. As an individual, you can actually go in and trade currencies online with an online clearing team that clear your trades with other individuals or banks. You can call your bank and trade your currency, you're going to get a retail rate. But if I called up Bank of America and said, I have 20,000 in yen, you know, what can I get for US? Or I have 10 million in yen, I'll get a better rate with my 10 million than I will with my 20,000. But if I'm trying to speculate and buy currencies for investments and for profits, I'm stuck either in a commodities contract with any commodities broker, which will call you on the phone and try to get you to open an account for 5,000 to trust them, and hopefully that goes well. Or I can go take a day trading class and or an online course and trade at 2 a.m. all night long and see what happens.
Can you participate in a fund which is biased or heavily weighted towards foreign exchange?
That's the part about finding, when you ask about the perfect mixture, I don't think that mutual funds provide a super different risk exposure than the next fund down the road. There's different assets and different types of technologies or international. But with hedge funds, you can find hedge fund managers that manage assets in a way that is very close to what you want. We're all very different. We have very, very different techniques. But what's the same about us is that we get paid if we perform, which means we have to perform. And two, we have more tools. Sometimes the minimums are very high for hedge funds. $100,000 minimum is very, very normal. And that's why I say that if you can't make the minimum and you feel it's where you want to go, then an investment club is a great way to get into that. Understand that it's considered high risk. Hedge funds have less reporting requirements than mutual funds do. And although they've outperformed them on an index basis, there's still security in, I guess, the beaten path. But on a personal level, you know, I would never put a dollar in a mutual fund again in my life based on what I know about hedge funds and managers, whether I'm doing it or whether I'm buying somebody else's services. A lot of hedge funds, by the way, use other managers. It's called funds of funds. You've got a great group of funds together. And so instead of maybe six asset classes in a fund, which a fund will have, maybe you'll have six funds in a fund, and they're all diversified. So it's a great world, especially for the entrepreneur and the person that wants to be a sophisticated investor per se, but doesn't fool themselves into thinking that that means that they should be doing the allocations. So let me give you an example of just understanding the time value of money. If you had a tax-deferred account, or if you were able to have an international structure, maybe a Nevis LLC, or whatever you have, that was able to invest on a tax-deferred basis. What I mean by tax-deferred is this. If you are structured properly and you have an international business, just like if you have a Nevada corporation and it earns money, you're not paying taxes in your home state. If you have a company that's located somewhere that has no taxes on it, that money grows tax-free. But if you take the money back as a U.S. citizen and you spend it, then my understanding is you're taxable on it, you know, as long as you put yourself in that box. So when you repatriate funds, I believe that's the time to be accountable. So here's an example of something I feel is super legitimate. Let's say you've got the international structure and I don't. You have $100, I have $100. We put it in an investment that yields 10% a year. Now, we assume it's 28% marginal tax rate, and like every 50 years, there is an estate tax, death tax that equates to, I think, 15%. If we do that and put it in the bank, pay the tax every year, do all that stuff, in 150 years or three generations, I hate to put you on the spot, but what do you think it grows to?
I'm just going to pull a number out of the air, and I'm going to say the $100 in 150 years would grow to $12,000.
That's a super common answer. It grows to $2.8 million. And that's after taxes. And Einstein said that the most powerful force in the universe is compound interest. Now, that was my story. I was doing it the way that I understand in the U.S., that I invest personally, I pay the taxes every year, and I let the estate tax go. But now you have a way that you were set up, that you had a legitimate international structure. It invested in the same U.S. account that I did. It just didn't pay taxes every year, and it didn't have any estate taxes, because when you died, you simply transferred to your next of kin and went on. So that same amount of money, and we'll just put you on the spot again. What do you think that grows to? It was $2.8 million.
So let's put it up to $500 million, just as a wild guess.
That was good, because most people don't believe it was $160 million. So it goes from $2.8 to $160 million. Now, that's like a 90 times difference. I mean, it's exponential, right? That's the power of not just compound interest, but deferred taxation. Because now it's sitting out there, and you're the grandson, and you're thinking, you know what? I don't care about any fancy way to pull this money back. I want it all. I want it all. You're my accountant. Bring it back and pay what I have to pay. So you bring $160 million back. And let's just say that on that, you pay 50% tax. Who knows what it would be? You have $80 million left. You've done your government a phenomenal service by managing money well for them. You've paid your taxes. You're as patriotic as you can be. And you're up about $78 million. That is the power of not just simple deferred compound on a dollar, but it's also what we as Americans get raped of every day if we don't pay attention. And that may be a strong word, but you know, ignorance is not bliss. We live in a society where we've got distractions galore, yet somebody that's putting not $100, let's say $10,000 in a nice little investment account for their child, in maybe an educational IRA, which can be used for all sorts of things, tax-free loans, tax-deferred, and down the road, they'll take their money out because they understood. Somebody else has taken $50,000, put it in a tax-advantaged trust or company of some sort, investing it properly, deferring the taxes, and when the time comes, they're bringing that money back properly, whatever that means, paying the right taxes on it, but they are so far ahead of the game that their family doesn't have to worry about the things that 98% of us have to worry about. It's not illegal, immoral, fattening. It's not magic. There's no secret to it. It's just making good choices and using the laws that are available, the statutes, the things that we understand the right way, keeps us in the box, keeps us very understandable to everyone around us, yet rewards us immensely.
I heard a story once that when Manhattan Island was purchased, it was for about $28 worth of beads and mirrors and trinkets. And if you try to calculate the value of the property on Manhattan Island today, you're up into trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars in real estate and various other solid assets. The interesting thing is that if you took the $28 back in whenever that purchase was made and you put it into compound interest in a bank account, tax deferred, today it would be worth just about what Manhattan Island is actually worth.
Isn't that amazing? Part of the reason I invest the way that I do is I'm a bit of a control freak. Public companies scare me because I can't control what's going to happen. If I go on vacation, I don't want to watch, you know, the market in the morning. So if I was to do equities of some sort, I'd hire somebody. But I do like to invest. I like to make my own decisions. I like to look for deals. But there are things out there to invest in that are super safe, but provide a great return. I'll give you an example. Recently, someone had a situation come up where they had a lien on their house, IRS problems. They were trying to sell their house, but couldn't sell it until they cleared the lien. All sorts of issues came up. So I loaned them $60,000 at 5% a month interest. And in place of that, I took a $200,000 lien on the home, which had about $800,000 equity in it still. So I had an asset-backed loan with a very good asset and a great position, and I had other contractual rights to force a sale if I had to, and I made a good interest on it. It was from someone that I knew. They considered it to be a very fair interest rate. They offered it. I accepted it. There are lots of asset-backed loans out there waiting for you every day if you want to go that route. You have to understand that, I guess, the best case scenario would have been that he didn't pay me back, and I could have foreclosed on the house financially. I'm glad he did. I don't want to foreclose on it, but It worked out. Some people like to invest in real estate liens. Some folks think that's gross. Some folks think that you're providing a service. But either way, it's a relatively safe investment at a decent rate. The other thing that I kind of like, but I am in no way inviting, is private offerings. You know, I'm in the investment field. I see a lot more than I need to, obviously, so I'm not looking for any private offerings. But when I see something really good and I understand it and it makes sense, I like to get involved. Recently, I got involved with a real estate development in Texas, a big golf course and hotel thing. A lawyer of mine was putting it together. I understand it. I did it. Another gentleman was putting together a company that has a pretty innovative way to clean up oil spills. It's a smart investment. It's good. So there are ways to invest, I believe, and be out of the box and look for higher yields that make a lot of sense, where getting those higher yields from strangers with small amounts, to me, just seems like you're looking for something that is going to hurt you in the end.
So to summarize some of the things that you've said today, if you want to invest in the big markets, whether it's currency or hedge funds, and you don't want to do this 24 hours a day full time and pay attention and do your day-to-day management, the smart thing to do is find someone who does that, a professional full-time manager. And in addition to that, you have the option of private investment opportunities which come to you on a personal basis, which are not publicly offered, of good ideas, good real estate plans, good technology innovations, where you can do the due diligence and see that the timing is right in the current market. And then you say, this is something that I'd like to get on board with. And maybe one of those things turns out very well, but the chances of it turning out adequately are something within your control that fall under the umbrella of what you're actually interested enough in to pay attention to it and watch it and carry it through.
Right. And in addition to the asset-backed loan, if I'm going to put money into, let's say, a private offering or something, I probably am not going to invest in something that has one option, which is an IPO. There's one rocket ship that's going to take off. If this happens, we're rich. If I were to invest in something private offering wise, it's got to make a profit in the meantime. I have to have ownership and a right to those profits. And if it goes public, if whatever event happens that's supposed to happen, that's great. But in the meantime, I have a good return on my money. So I would just say that if you're going to do private offerings and you're not sophisticated, you're not doing them for the IPO only, really make sure that you can get something. If the 90% chance of it not going public or not having that big event happens, you still want to make your earnings. There's a lot of them out there. They may seek you out, but if you start looking for them, you can find them too. If I were to just encapsulate kind of the whole talk, what I'm trying to say is that there is no magic. There's nothing that probably you or I don't have access to that somebody else does. There are good planners. There are good investments. There are bad planners and bad investments. Your job is not to make bad choices, is to hire the right people. My suggestion to a lot of people, they get confused with offshore planning, is to call Ernst Young over in the Cayman Islands. Call a Big Six or a Big Five or a Big Three, whatever that's going to be after all this mess. But go to the best out there and search for the answers. Somebody's doing it somewhere. It's legal. And anyone else that is offering you a structure, an investment, an opportunity, if they can't give you a ton of information on it, just don't do it. It's not worth it. There's nothing that is so secret that I can't share it with you. There are offerings that are private. There are situations that are sensitive. Get a permission for your lawyer to talk to the lawyer representing whatever it is. They can have a private discussion, and your lawyer can't tell you what they talk about, but your lawyer can say, yes, it's good or yes, it's bad. There are ways to always make sure that it feels good before you do it. You should never have to invest and really be nervous about it.
For additional information on this topic, go to your online resource center at www.pqionline.cc. Click on Products and Solutions and go to Disc number 14.